Can't live with you, can't live without you, Facebook. This seems to be where we all are with social media. Although digital insiders like Mark are maybe the most conflicted. In Silicon Valley, the birthplace of the internet, parents are reportedly kicking their own kids off social media. And Jaron Lanier, the visionary computer scientist who helped build the internet and invent virtual reality, thinks we should all delete our social media accounts. Right now. Steve Paulson wondered, all of them?
Jaron, let me start out by asking about your own digital footprint. You are not on Facebook or Twitter or any other social media platform, right?
That's right.
And you don't have any hidden anonymous accounts?
Oh, no. I mean, there was a time when some of my cats would get accounts just so I could kind of keep up with what's going on. But it really seems beside the point at this time. So you can live a full life and you can even write books and promote them without being on social media.
So you are a very active user of the internet, but just specifically social media, you stay away from that.
What I stay away from is extremely specific. It's the behind-the-scenes manipulative algorithms that measure people and put them in a Skinner box by creating personalized feeds that are engineered by algorithm to modify those people for the benefit of third parties who are sneaky and often unseen. That is the thing I avoid. Not only am I an active internet user, I really like the internet. I mean, I was the chief scientist of Internet 2, the main academic consortium figuring out how to scale the internet in the 90s. I've put a lot of effort into the internet. I continue to. I kind of love the internet, but the manipulation engine is the thing that I think is very much worth avoiding, and it's also very avoidable.
So when you talk about the manipulation engine, are you talking about specific companies like Facebook and Twitter and I suppose Google as well?
Yeah. So what happened was when those companies were being founded, let's say from when Google was founded to when Facebook was founded, there was this very strong wave of idealism in the tech world that everything should be free. Nobody should be excluded. An exemplary design like that might be the Wikipedia. Everybody's a volunteer. And there was a lot of feeling that that would be the best way forward for society. But we had to reconcile that with this other thing that we also loved, which was these larger-than-life entrepreneurs and hackers who could dent the universe, as Steve Jobs put it, these creatures with extraordinary ability to change the course of history through their creativity and force of will. And so if you love entrepreneurs, but you want everything to be free, there's only one way to get both at once, which is with the advertising model where things look free, but actually there's somebody to the side putting money in. And as long as that's sort of a low-tech thing, as it was at the start, it's kind of not a problem. But everything's gotten accelerated. The computers have gotten much bigger. The algorithms have gotten better. The people who use the system have become more sophisticated. And what started out as advertising has turned into something sinister. And, you know, I have a really easy measure for whether something online is part of this manipulation machine or not. And that is, did Putin's psych warfare units use it. So if Putin wasn't there, it's probably okay. So Putin was all over Facebook, Google and YouTube, Reddit, Twitter, of course. And so that's a pretty indication that those things are subsumed by the manipulation model, which I think we must learn to overcome.
Hmm. So you have come up with 10 arguments for why you think we should delete our social media accounts. And let's talk about a few of them. For starters, they are addictive. And you say the founders of Facebook actually knew this very early on, that their algorithms were designed to get people addicted to the next click, the next dopamine hit, and all of that.
This is a question that fascinates me. So Sean Parker, who's the first president of Facebook, has said that they deliberately used addictive techniques similar to the techniques that gambling businesses use to get people addicted to gambling. Now, here's the thing. I used to know Sean Parker, and I knew him socially during the time when Facebook was nascent. And I don't think he knew. You know, like I kind of wonder if maybe Sean is kind of remembering himself as more of a Bond villain than he really was. Because based on my direct experience of the people involved at the time, I believe this was more of a terrible mistake we all fell into rather than a deliberate plan.
Hmm. So what exactly makes Facebook so addictive?
This is based on the science of behaviorism, which started in the 19th century. The brain is fascinated by the world. The brain is looking for patterns. The brain is always trying to uncover that extra hidden layer. And so if you give feedback that isn't perfect, that has unpredictable timing, that has an element of noise to it, the brain actually latches onto it and becomes ever more entranced with the possibility that more could be understood.
The example of that would be you post something and, you know, you get feedback. You get likes or comments or whatever, and that's the hit.
Yeah. And so the algorithms are watching you. There's an enormous amount of information of an ever widening variety that can include things like your gait, meaning the way you walk, your facial expressions, certainly who you know, what you buy, where you go, all kinds of things. The personalized feed or the ads or whatever it might be, all these things are adjusted to increase. The term of art is engagement, but that's really just what we call addiction.
On the other hand, all those people like me who do use Facebook, it's very easy to stay in touch with people. Or for someone like me in the media to get the word out about some of the projects I'm doing, it seems very useful in a lot of ways.
Well, look, I never claim to know what's best for any individual. And there might be individuals for whom it really does make sense to stay on the accounts. But I also have to say that people in the media are some of the worst addicts. I see reporters
checking. Oh, that's absolutely true. You're right.
No, you guys, you're checking your Twitter feeds constantly in this way that's just insane. You have a problem that you need to address, honestly. Twitter addiction is destroying a lot of people's lives. It's destroyed Trump's character. It's recently destroyed Elon Musk's and caused his stock to suffer. But it's destroying journalism because so many journalists are so addicted to this quick feedback loop that it degrades your sensibility. So I'm sorry to turn, I don't mean to make this about you. I know I'm the one being interviewed.
Yeah.
But when I hear journalists.
No, I hear you. And I, okay. You know, I kind of agree with you.
All right. I don't know that it's harder than getting people to stop smoking in public places. I mean, that was, those who aren't old enough to remember might have a hard time grasping how difficult that is. Nicotine is profoundly addictive, and it was profoundly normalized, where every movie and every television show showed people smoking everywhere, and it was considered sort of weird not to smoke. But somehow we got through that. Somehow it changed.
So we've been talking a lot about the idealism of the early tech revolution in comparison to what it's become now when money is so dominant. And it seems like one of the huge ironies is that we hear that a lot of the top executives of the big tech companies, Facebook, Microsoft, so on, apparently are very strict about limiting the screen time of their own kids.
Yeah. You know, I live in Berkeley, which is kind of at the edge of what you might properly call the tech community, which is more in Silicon Valley itself and in San Francisco these days. But even so, my daughter's friends have parents who work at companies like Google and Facebook routinely. And I think we're more liberal with letting her use devices as she wishes and letting her learn her own lessons than they are. What I've seen, and this is widely reported, is that the engineers and executives at these companies are incredibly strict with their kids, and there tend to be a lot of kids in Waldorf schools or sort of supernatural schools. And sometimes when I visit the homes of parents of my daughter's friends, we'll be asked to turn our phones off. Like, it's a real Luddite environment, even though there's this beautiful house that was paid for by the tech industry. I actually, within the tech industry, experience myself as more trying to be a moderate and finding a middle ground. What I find is a lot of the people who are successful in it are pretty extremist in feeling that it's a bad thing in their own lives.
So I want to step back for a bit, because what makes your argument so fascinating is your own personal history. I mean, you were one of the early pioneers of all this new digital technology we've been talking about, and one of those tech entrepreneurs, hackers, who helped create the culture that we now call Silicon Valley. You're partly to blame for all of this.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and I think it's important for Silicon Valley people to recognize that. I will accept my portion of blame. Although that said, I have to say that I was one of the earliest critics of this stuff. I was writing about how we were making a mistake as early as 92, as were a few others, sometimes at great personal cost because I lost friends over it. People thought I was betraying our common goal. But despite that, I absolutely do share blame.
I know you had a pretty difficult childhood. Your mother died early when you were 10. You lived for a while in the desert with your dad, practically off the grid. You were bullied at school. You seem to be the classic case of the kid who didn't fit in. And I guess I'm wondering if that's I know this sort of it's cheap psychology here, but is that partly what led you into your fascination with technology?
Well, as difficult as my childhood was, which is mostly about my mother dying in a car accident when I was small, we should keep some perspective here. I did have a difficult childhood. On the other hand, my mother survived being in a concentration camp, and today our government is wrenching children away from their parents, never to be seen again. So compared to either of those, my childhood was not that difficult. I mean, to me, technology was about connecting with other people. I felt so isolated after my mom died that I wondered how I could ever connect with other people. I felt very alone. And so I imagined virtual reality as this thing where people would be together in this world that could be fantastical, that could convey some of these experiences that you didn't know how to put into words that you couldn't otherwise share. And I still think it can be that. I still think it's most beautiful when it functions in that way, although that's rare. I mean, look, this cuts to something that I think is really important, which is, to me, criticism or complaint is the face. It's the expression of optimism, because the person who's the critic is the one who believes that things can be better in the future. The complacent person is the person who's the enemy of the future. It's the complacent person who is the true pessimist. So I view these criticisms as an act of optimism.
Jaron Lanier, talking with Steve Paulson. Jaron's a senior scientist at Microsoft, and you can read more of his criticisms in his book, 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media, right now.